Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you so very much. Good morning, everyone. So the picture that I'm putting up is sort of to visualize sort of the main emotion feeling that I want to support with my presentation, which is between universal aspirations and pluralistic realities. So on one hand, this picture shows the universal aspirations, the optimism of all these flags of the nations trying to, it's a picture that you find when you Google United Nations, you find underpinning the ideals of the United Nations, states coming together to try and find better solutions to jointly work towards peace and security. On the other hand, you also see the plurality. You see very many different flags, many different positions, interests, and so forth. So it is exactly on that brink that I'm trying to write in this paper. And it is about the crime of aggression. It's about negotiating the crime of aggression. And it's part of my PhD research. I'm trying to develop a little further. And my PhD research was on the crime of aggression, the law and politics of the crime of aggression. And the part that I'm developing in this paper further is the negotiation history. And I'm trying to look at the entire sort of I also go back to way back when, but I focus in this particularly on the discourse of the last 100 years or so, so since the First World War. To start out with, we've talked yesterday about legalism, we talked about realism. To sort of set the kind of analytical positioning for my research is that what I found is that neither really explained the following puzzle, neither legalism or realism. So if the realists are right that international law doesn't really have much to offer, then why for the last 100 years we've seen states fight so hard to get to a definition of aggression? Right? On the other hand, if the legalists are right that we have now found the definition of aggression, and we actually had them already in 1974 because the current crime of aggression amendment that will be operationalized probably soon really refers back to 1974. I'll go back to this in my presentation. But if the legalists are right that actually that text gives us all the clear guidance that we need and we've now defined aggression, then why do we still see such fundamental contestation on that norm, on what exactly aggression is, what exactly, what use of force is humanitarian or necessary or just or whatever different states invoke to say that it is justified and what is not. So in my research, I tried to show the limitations of these, well, simplified versions of looking at the difficulty, the intense complexity when the international legal order tries to address an inherently political and inherently problematic or difficult, challenging concept, namely that very fundamental right or need, it's both, and there are very many other things, for a state to use force when it really, really is convinced it needs to. So I use a constructivist approach, and some others have noted as well. Even though in this paper I focus on states and state conduct, that does not mean that I think that international law can be understood by solely focusing on what states do. So I use a constructivist approach and look at the ways that different actors interact in the construction process and the reconstruction and the reshaping of this norm. I also therefore use Stanley Fish's understanding of interpretative communities and Ian Johnstone's way of dealing with that in these kinds of concepts, processes. So I look not just to what states do, but also the way that judges and other practitioners invoke the norm, apply the norm, NGOs, all sorts of actors calling upon the ICC to come to the rescue and so forth, media and us practitioners. So the way I divide that is into four groups of norm constructors or legal entrepreneurs. And that is the norm negotiators, and that is what this paper focuses on. So that's the diplomats, etc., the ones that come together. And it's not diplomats in a narrow sense, but it's all those that come together in these diplomatic negotiations, which very often actually consists of a very interesting mix between professional diplomats, lawyers from different departments that are pulled into the specific negotiations, but also academics. So you see a lot of our friends on these delegations as well. So the norm negotiators, then the norm appliers, so the judges, the prosecutors, the defense counsel, and everyone involved in the legal process of actually using that norm that is negotiated at a diplomatic setting, but then using it and therefore shaping it and further developing, interpreting, contesting it, etc. Then a third category of norm invokers. So the norm invokers, I then mean, for instance, in, well, let's say Syria now, a peace process or war zone, and lots of others, you hear invocations of the International Criminal Court, International Criminal Justice, and there's rationales to that. Like, and so I try to look at that, like, why? What exactly are they hoping that International Criminal Justice is going to do for them? And then a fourth category of norm discussants, with which I mostly mean people like us, that we're talking about it and we're looking at it. So in that way, I look at the way that norm construction occurs. And in this paper, particularly, I focus on that aspect of it, the norm negotiators, and so the diplomatic delegations. And so the story that I'm trying to convey in this paper is about what I saw in my research is that there's basically, if you look at the past 100 years, and basically what you see is at least what I see, is a repeat, like a rehearsal in three different settings we'll go into, in which there is a struggle between legal autonomy and state autonomy or state power. So there is a desire, the universal aspiration to create law, to deal with aggressive war, hunting mankind as long as we've lived together. So there's this idea, let's define aggression, aggressive war between states, aggressive war between peoples, and put that in, well, first of all, a norm. So it became, like, from a right, it turned into a prohibition, 1945, and aggression was regulated in a body of law and then became a crime already in the Nuremberg situation, so after 45, but now most recently trying to operate this, operationalize this within the context of the International Criminal Court. So on the one hand, you see that aspiration. On the other hand, when you look at these processes of negotiation, you see that in the end, time and again, the norms that actually come out of this are kept very open. And you can look at this as like a failure and we need to do it again, etc. What I find more useful is to look at it as, what Chesties laid out yesterday, like the need for a clear distinction between the is and the ought. So notwithstanding what we believe should be occurring, I find it more interesting to look at what is occurring and trying to understand that. And the way I understand it is that this is a struggle between wanting to give a legal autonomy, wanting to give a court the autonomy to decide over all these matters, particularly and foremost to protect, you know, each state wanting to protect itself and its allies against the aggression of others, while at the same time fearing to give away that autonomy and wanting to maintain the state autonomy, the sovereignty, the power to decide for themselves when the need or the justice is so overriding that there's a fundamental need, justness, to go to war. The problem, of course, being that when that occurs, almost always do other states at that point fundamentally disagree with the need for that use of force. So it's been sort of in history, it's shown that there's fundamental disagreement when it comes down to it in exact cases. So beyond the abstract that war is bad and aggression is a crime, when it comes to concrete situations, there's fundamental disagreement on whether a war is humanitarian or necessary, in fact, for oil or power or, well, et cetera. We all read the news. So what I want to try and bring out in the paper is describe three processes to show this, the way that that comes to the fore and the way that that then translates into particular kinds of norms. So it is about a norm construction process, the norm making, as well as, of course, describing some doctrinal aspects to the extent that is necessary. So look at three phases. That is 1945. That is then the run-up to 1974, the General Assembly definition of aggression, and it is the crime of aggression, and most particularly the definition, the amendment that was agreed upon in Kampala, Uganda, in 2010. Now, the situation with it currently is that there is a there's an amendment, as we all know, but just to refresh you all, there's an amendment to the international, to the Rome Statute that says that the International Criminal Court will be able to exercise its jurisdiction over the crime of aggression pending a decision to be taken after the 1st of January 2017, which is now, and after at least 30 ratifications, which we also have. So it is, to me at least, a little unclear still what exactly is going to happen in New York between 4 and 14 December of this year. But it's definitely going to be on the agenda that something's going to happen. And I think it remains to be seen, but if there's insiders to it, I'm very curious to hear what you think will be happening in New York. I know that I'll be there, and I'll be very interested in seeing how this unfolds further. So to go back to the past, I think what's interesting is to see that in 1945, after the Second World War, states wanted to, the Allied states, the victor states, were discussing coming together at the London Conference to set up the Nuremberg Tribunal and then later also the Tokyo Tribunal. What they set out to do there is, well, they all agreed, so the US, UK, France, and Soviets, they all agreed that they wanted to prosecute the Nazi leaders and then the Japanese leaders later for crimes against peace. So that's what they called the crime of aggression back then. They didn't really agree on how to do that. Well, they, you know, so France, for instance, had a big problem with the whole idea that the crime of aggression was actually prohibited and criminalized, well, was criminalized according to international law. So they were against defining aggression because they said, yes, we see a development in regulations. There's treaties that are pointing out to aggression, denouncing it as a national policy and so forth, but that hasn't arisen to the to being an actual crime with criminal implications to it. Russia was on the side with the French, but for different reasons. Though they agreed that there was no crime, but also really thought it was very dangerous to formulate this as a crime because. They were kind of saying, well, we don't really care what we do with the Nazis. We can also execute them and it's fine to do a legal process as long as we don't formulate law that will be used against, well, all of us in later stages. So this does not belong to the realm of law in the sense that it becomes so formulated formalistically that we just don't know how it's going to be used, and we know it's going to be a problematic definition for the future. So more of a realistic approach to it. The US and the UK, on the other hand, were very much on the line here, and this is interesting because they flip around in later years. The US and UK were very much on the line of, it's very important that we define this specifically because it's a crime, it's a tribunal, criminal judges will be ruling over this. And so if we don't define it precisely, there will be all sorts of ways to justify war and to get away with it, which, of course, because it's a criminal procedure, a defendant is allowed to do. They should have that right. So we need to define this clearly. Well, so the camps were broken. They couldn't agree. And so they agreed on including the notion of aggression in, or the crimes against peace, in Article 6A of the tribunal, or of the statute. But then they didn't define it any further. So it was delegated how to deal with it to the judges. And the judges, they dealt with it. They prosecuted Nazi leaders and later Japanese leaders in the Tokyo Tribunal. And by just referring that, you know, well, it's kind of clear what it is, and we don't really need to define. It's no problem. So it basically sort of like, you know, it's like porn, you know? You know it when you see it, and at least it is clear that what has occurred for the Nazis and the Japanese, that is aggression, so end of it. So then after that, and there's also a relevant development here, is that just before these tribunals, this discussion obviously also had occurred in the United Nations, with the creation of the United Nations, because the notion of aggression is in Chapter 7 of the UN Charter. And there as well, you saw in the discussions that states just couldn't really agree on how to define it. So they decided, well, let's just, you know, throw in the term and then we'll see. That at least they could agree on. So this is the setting of 1945. That states could agree on that aggression was a fundamental notion that needed to be included, but not so much on what exactly it meant. And at least for the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals, they were clear enough that at least what they were judging was aggression. So that's where we were in 1945. So then came a process, so the United Nations then created a special committee. And the special committee then said, oh, we don't know how to do that, let's create a second special committee. And so they also agreed, oh, we fundamentally disagree on what it is, so let's create a third special committee. And then a fourth special committee. And then within that fourth special committee, because they did come to the 1974 definition of aggression, but it took quite some time. Within that, these committees, what you saw is all sorts of disagreement on all sorts of aspects to the definition of aggression, but also very fundamentally on whether or not to have a definition, which is sort of the story that I'm trying to bring out. Now, the interesting thing what happens in sort of that process is that there's just such craftiness, I think, of this negotiation process, is that at some point, the leaders of these commissions, at some point, three proposals came to the table. So they stimulated parties to do that. So on the one hand, there was the Soviet proposal, and there was also a 13-power proposal, and then there was a 6-power proposal. And the 6-power proposal were the US and the UK and Canada and Australia. They had always been, so this is really interesting if you compare it to the London conference before, so 1945, these 6-power proposals, so now these states that had this permanent position in the Security Council, well, Russia, of course, as well, but now these states, US and UK, were very much against defining it at all. So they were the ones saying, like, whoa, this is really, you know, let's just leave it to the Security Council. Let's not define it. If we put this in the hands of courts, that's unwise because it's such a political and such a complicated notion. So the whole process then like turned, because they actually had then in 1974, or 1969, close to it, they had finally actually put down a proposal. And then what happens, because they put down a proposal, what the diplomatic process then went to was that create all sorts of little subgroups, contact groups, working groups, and at some point drafting groups, to really focus on all the substantive little issues, not little, substantive issues in these proposals. And so by actually focusing on what the three different proposals all disagreed on, and you know, they circumvented the entire question of whether or not there should be a definition. So this created this breakthrough that at that point, they were actually just conduct that discussion, and it came down to a definition. Now, the definition that then was agreed on in 74 was very interesting, so it kind of incorporated all sorts of aspects of all the proposals. Then they couldn't really agree on that, but the way to circumvent that was by saying in Article 2, well, but the Security Council can decide that something that maybe prima facie would appear aggression isn't. And in Article 4, well, in Article 3, it noted all sorts of examples of what could be aggression, but then Article 4 says, but that's not an exhaustive list, and the Security Council can decide that anything else is also aggression. So basically what you see in the 1974 definition was an idea of like creating guidelines for this UN Security Council, which was also explicitly set, but not to limit the Security Council. The Security Council basically was the ones that could still decide over what is and what is not aggression. So it was working towards sort of like refining the scope somewhat, but not giving it in the hands of legal autonomy. Now, afterwards, then for a while there was not a lot of discussion, or there was a lot of discussion, but not a lot of development. This 1974 definition wasn't invoked much in the Security Council at all, so the whole notion of aggression was circumvented mostly. And but then when the ICC was negotiated in the process up to 1998, there was of course this sentiment that, well, without the crime of aggression, the Rome Statute, the ICC would not be whole because it was, as this Nuremberg Tribunal said, the crime of crimes, the supreme crime. So there was again this discussions coming up, and again a problem of really agreeing on, in the concrete, how do we deal with this? So, you know, concretely comes down to, is use of force humanitarian? Then if we put in humanitarian intervention as a crime of aggression, then, well, we're stopping all sorts of necessary interventions and needs to help you know, prevent basically what the UN Charter is meant to do, so help prevent all sorts of fundamental violations of human rights, whilst on the other hand, if we do allow humanitarian intervention, so if it's not within the scope of the crime of aggression, then we sort of stimulate or allow use of force, and isn't that in the preamble of the United Nations, to the whole purpose of the UN to prevent war, the scourge of war, etc. So there's these problems of two fundamental notions of what the whole UN is supposed to be, preventing war, preventing slaughter with war, that contested in these discussions. So eventually what you saw happening in then Kampala was that they came up with the word manifest. So the Kampala process then negotiated, again, sort of referred to the 1974, pretty open definition. But then in order to have sort of to deal with this aspect of how do we protect other, how do we protect ourselves from others' aggression, and how do we maintain the rights for us and our allies to use force for the right purpose, for the good purposes, they came up with the clause that a crime of aggression is an illegal use of force that is also a manifest violation by its character, gravity, and scale of the United Nations Charter. Now, the problem there is, and I'm going to round up because I'm ending my time, but the problem here is that it is obviously, again, fundamentally contested what that manifest is. Is manifest violation of the UN Charter any use of force that is not strictly understood as self-defense, responding to an imminent armed attack or an armed attack occurring? So then how do we deal with responding to terrorism, which, you know, obviously state practice shows that states are using force against, and so forth, or how the interpretations of the UN Charter, right? Like, for instance, we saw with the Libya intervention, what happens when you interpret a little bit further, or when you disagree on how the authorization by the UN Security Council is to be interpreted, and obviously the whole humanitarian intervention aspect. So some states say, well, manifest is to exclude all of these discussions. So if we have any, like Harold Coe, for instance, say on behalf of the US, if we have any discussions, if it is contested, then it falls beyond the scope of the crime of aggression. Well, in that kind of understanding, the scope of the crime of aggression would be super small because it pretty much is always contested, other than like a crazy crazy dictator throwing a nuclear bomb on an island somewhere. That's not the reality of it. The reality are situations around Crimea and and all sorts of like Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, and so forth. So on the other hand, there were then most states saying, the crime of aggression needs to be encompassing, like it needs to be a real norm. But then you saw the discussions of exactly that contestation that had been reoccurring over and over again. So where do we now stand? What I think, and this is between the is and the ought, right? The is, what I think, what happened over and over again, 45, 74, and now in 2010, is that states wants to have that universal aspiration to try and use law and courts of law to create a space for legal autonomy, while on the same hand also being very fearful in actually delegating that to that extent. And that what actually occurs is a delegation of that contestation elsewhere, so off the diplomat's table, off to the discursive space that occurs most concretely by the norm appliers, so in the by the judicial authorities to develop. That has some problems in terms of legal certainty. This is a criminal norm, is obvious, I think, and that is. But that it has some aspirations for the good is also obvious. So, to be continued, I'd say, but for what I'm trying to do in this paper is show this as a case study of the way that realities and aspirations lead to particular kind of norm construction, a particular kind of norms, openness, but with good hopes. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.